Go.
All right, this is the 20th episode of the Right Dishonourable podcast. And this is the second time we're having to record the introduction because Jazza left the loop button on GarageBand. And I feel that that very much is emblematic of the way this podcast has gone over the past 20 weeks, if you can believe it.
20 weeks without stop.
This is true,
like I'm genuinely really impressed with this. Well done.
Well done, us.
Let's get a beer later.
Yes, let's do that. I'm, because we now to introduce ourselves properly, I'm Jimmy Nichols.
I'm Jazza John.
And we talk about politics, social issues and current affairs and all that good stuff. And this week we are going to be talking, firstly, about the Chinese president's visit to Britain.
How do you pronounce his name, Jimmy? I just taught you.
Xi Jinping.
Xi Jinping.
Xi Jinping.
Good. Well done. You'll be fluent in no time.
Progress. And his visit to Britain and what that means for human rights and or the lack thereof in China and what it means for the economy in Britain, which appears to be the direction the British government's coming from.
Because what kind of an international relationship is worth it if it isn't based on economics?
Money is important.
Correct.
It is, in fact, the most important thing because we are all Thatcherites now.
Children of Thatcher, every one of us.
And then following on from that, or possibly preceding that, depending on how we order this, we're going to be talking about...
You fucked up this introduction already.
Yes, but we're just going to run with it. We're going to be talking about what Jermaine Greer said about transgender people on Newsnight this week.
Specifically transgender women, which is M to F transgender people. She doesn't think that they're women.
Yes, and the...
So I'll just leave that hanging in the air.
We'll comment on that later. And lastly, we are going to be discussing the new spin doctor of the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn, who is Seamus Milne, a sort of now former... He's on leave from The Guardian because his main job is as a Guardian columnist. And some of the things that he said in the past, particularly in relation to foreign policy and geopolitics and... His slight excuse making for Stalin's Russia and Stalin's USSR.
Oh, he loved his dogs.
Yeah, but
was
I mean,
that Hitler.
Hitler loved dogs and was a vegetarian and hated smoking.
Well, we wouldn't have gotten on. I'll be honest, we wouldn't have gotten on.
I hope that's like those aren't the main reasons you wouldn't have got on.
But, also because he wanted to like gas me, but like fine.
Details. And I think we're going to be doing the Jermaine Greer segment first because I fucked up the order.
We're going to do Jermaine Greer first, then we're going to do China, then we're going to do the spin doctory person. And I don't really understand anything about it, so Jimmy's going to explain that. Okay, music now. Good, excellent. La 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 la. It's recording.
It appears to have survived, Jazza, pressing the record button. Anyway, this week, the strident feminist, I think that's a fair way to describe her, Jermaine Greer, said some interesting things about transgender women on Newsnight.
Is she still a feminist now? Because she's not inclusive of all women.
I thought that was the point of... some strands of feminism.
Okay, so this is... since last week, when we've talked about feminism kind of at length, and I think probably made tits of ourselves a little bit, because we are two straight cis men. Oh, no, I'm not straight. We're two white cis men.
Breaking news.
We're two white cis men, and therefore only kind of, feminism, that sounds good. So I've gone away and done some reading about different waves...
See, I've warned you about doing research for this podcast. Okay. but go on.
Am I going to be kicked off now because I've learned things? So Jermaine Greer is very much a second wave feminist. And we're now in the fourth wave of feminism.
See, I said we're in the fourth wave.
Yeah, you were right.
I am still a cis straight man and I knew something about stuff.
What do you fucking want, a medal?
Yes.
Oh. Well, this is awkward.
Anyway, as a second wave feminist, like you can sort of explain what that is. But what did she say, and how does that kind of relate to her membership as a second wave feminist?
Germaine Greer has basically said on Newsnight, and very unapologetically, this was in response to her being uninvited to speak at the University of Cardiff. She essentially believes that male to female transgendered people are not women, and throughout the interview refused to use women to describe them, to the point where she even preferred to use he/she as the noun used for a transgender woman. And she's got very outdated views, some would argue, and it kind of throws up the stark contrast between second wave feminism and the previous waves, because second wave feminism was very much based around the liberation of white women generally. Third wave tried to encompass women of all backgrounds, so people who were of different ethnic minority backgrounds, transgender women and queer women. And now fourth wave is trying to be that's where I'm a bit confused.
So yeah, I think the waves thing, although I'm sure some of what you said is true, is more about
the goal, right? So the goal of first wave feminism was to get the vote. The goal of second wave feminism was equal pay, equality in the workplace. Third wave feminism was, hold on, everybody needs to have this shit as well. And fourth wave feminism was like, okay, let's keep doing that.
So yeah, from what I kind of have seen of Greer, the thing that to me differentiates her from a lot of feminists is that she's very much a kind of gender essentialist in terms of the way she thinks about men and women.
Describe gender essentialist.
I might not be using this term rightly. Mm-hmm. But what I mean by that is that some feminists think that the differences between men and women are, biologically speaking, are very minimal, and all the differences you see in how men and women behave are due to culture, basically, the majority of them are due to culture. There's obviously degrees of this. But the way Greer sees it, I think, is that men and women biologically are very different, and that when you get differences in behaviour, that is attributable to biology, basically.
So she believes quite strongly in the gender binary?
Yeah, I mean, that kind of is reflected in her comments about transgender people, right? So it does kind of fit into that. But in more general terms, it means that the way she views equality is quite different from somebody who doesn't really believe in gender essentialism. Mm-hmm. Because if you think that, say, the fact that women tend to speak more than men, like throughout the day they tend to speak more physically more words.
Yeah.
If you view that as biology, your approach to equality is going to be quite very different from if you view that as culture, because it limits the extent to which men and women can be equal in terms of, say, what sort of jobs they're going to do, or who's going to stay home and look after and raise the kids, and all of that sort of thing. So that's the way I see her as different from general feminists. I've now lost my train of thought.
Okay, so what Germaine, or Jerry, as I've taken to calling her now, what Jerry has been saying on Newsnight is going to be very shocking to a lot of people, especially nowadays when we've kind of accepted that transgender women are women. I feel like that is commonly seen in society.
Actually don't think that I think more people will side with her than actually, because I'm kind of, I almost don't care if people want to call themselves women, that's fine by me. I don't really dispute that. You, I think, are very firmly on the side of they are women, I'm guessing. But I think...
So the important thing that defines that is that transgender people, whether that's M2F or F2M, they will generally argue, I have always been a man or I have always been a woman. It was just externally things were a bit, you know, out of place. And so, and that was the thing that needed to kind of change. And what's very interesting is that she says that they should be able to change their external gender representation as they wish. They should be able to go under gender reassignment surgery if they wish. But the thing is, even now, in like the progressive world that we're in, it's still quite a long and arduous process. So you have to be living as that gender for a very long time, for at least a year or 2 years, I think. You need to be living as the gender that you're wanting to be assigned into.
Do you mean to get legal recognition?
To get legal recognition for you to be able to basically change your gender on your passport. Essentially, okay. It's the layman's way of being able to change it. You can't just wake up the next day and say, I'm going to be a woman today. It's not that easy.
But I actually think most people... we really should have consulted some polling to actually prove this one with Emma, but I think most people probably take more her view than take your view, if you put it that way.
Yes, but...
I'm not saying that's a good thing. I just think that it actually represents the majority view that if you are, say, male to female... transgender person mm-hmm. transitioning from being male to being female, as it were, if I mm-hmm. said that right. Most people, I think, will probably not see you properly as a woman. And that's not a view I hold. I just think that is probably the majority view.
So something that is very true is that transgender people do have a very different experience to life than those who are cisgendered. So they will... there's some very good... like studies on this that show that they are more likely to commit suicide, they're more likely to have mental illness, they're more likely to be homeless, they're more likely to be abused and harassed, especially if they are quote unquote passable in the street. And they suffer in this way to the extreme, like much more than any other kind of like group. And then when you get to transgender people of colour, it's even more extreme. And so to kind of discredit it's specifically a transgender woman's experience because they used to present themselves as a man, I think is quite dangerous. And so
I'm not sure you've represented her position very well on that.
Go on. So correct me.
Well, this is a point that not just her, but other feminists and like certain sections of feminism do have a problem with transgender people in general. Mm-hmm. And this tends to be the form that their argument takes, is that if you, it's kind of the point you just made, but in more extreme terms, mm-hmm. If you used to be a man and you transitioned into being a woman, I realise transgender people would potentially always consider themselves women, but if you see where I'm coming from on that, some feminists would say that you haven't experienced the same oppression that they have experienced because they've always been a woman, if you see what I mean. And therefore, they don't really want to recognise you as a woman. And that appears to me to be kind of Jermaine Greer's position.
Yeah, I have a huge issue with using the phrase, have always been a woman. But what's very interesting is that...
That's a fair representation of what they actually, of how they actually think, right?
But when you start presenting yourself as a woman, and when you decide to transition, you do still, you become a victim of misogyny. Mm. And to say that, you're not actually experiencing the same kind of misogyny that a quote-unquote real woman experiences is absolutely ridiculous, because a transgender woman specifically, will become a victim of misogyny and then also become a victim of transphobia, and so actually they get a double whammy and they get.
Can you actually be a victim of misogyny in terms of structural misogyny and transphobia at the same time?
I think it's possible. Yeah,
it doesn't seem
in terms of being so. There's a lot of kind of fetishization of transgender people, because history. And so your chances of being kind of like felt up and catcalled go up because you're a woman, because you present as a woman. But then also if somebody finds out that you are a transgender, then you will get transgender hate directed at you as well. And it seemed like, oh, look, you're being tricked by this monster, this transgendered person who pretended to be a woman so that they could get you into bed. Like, there's a huge history of that in, like, media representation as well, in terms of the trans woman being kind of like the trickster, the person who kind of tricks the straight man into either coming to bed or into falling in love with her, and then all of a sudden, oh, hold on, I used to have a penis between my legs, and that's a very bad thing, and they're portrayed as monsters.
So it's
definitely a different experience that transgender people have to cisgender women, but I don't think that that discredits the fact that they are treated differently by our society because they are women, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I do see where you're coming from, I think. But in terms of Jermaine Greer's free speech point, she presented this as, this is just my opinion. As you said earlier, she doesn't want transgender people to be harassed. She just doesn't really think that they are, that male to female transgender people are women, and she presumably doesn't think that female to male transgender people are men.
To the point where she'll call them he, she.
Yeah, I mean,
when she said that, I literally banged my head against, like, I was just blown away by the stupidity. Because she's a very clever woman, is Jermaine Greer, and she's...
I don't think it's stupidity. I think that that just is what she thinks.
But why would you choose a transgender slur like he, she, to describe somebody, rather than just using a gender-neutral pronoun like they?
See, I didn't realise it was a slur, so maybe she doesn't realise it's a slur. I wouldn't say it.
I would be so surprised. Because she... This is, like, what she's meant to be... No,
this is her job.
Her thing. Yeah, this is her job is to know about, like, gender theory and shit. But, so, I want to talk about the freedom of speech thing. I presumably think, knowing you, that you think that she should be allowed to talk at somewhere like University of Cardiff.
Yeah, I mean, I actually haven't read the article, so you might have to fill me in on the details, but she was barred from speaking at the event, which wasn't to do with anything to do with transsexuality or transgenderism.
Yeah.
But she was barred from speaking on a completely unrelated topic because presumably the student union got their knickers in a twist, to use an unfortunate phrase.
That was a very unfortunate phrase that popped into your head there, Johnny. So I think that it is significant. So I genuinely land on the side of people shouldn't be barred from speaking, but I do understand why, because I believe the topic that she was being asked to talk about was women and power in the 20th century. And if you're going to say that this type of woman is not it does not belong in this conversation, then you're deciding to, like, completely rewrite history and say that transgender women in the 20th century are not part of the conversation about being a woman. If it were something specifically about cisgendered women, then...
But she's still allowed to have that opinion and speak on the topic, though, isn't she? Even if, as you say, it isn't, it's...
Yeah, I think that people who have views like this should still be allowed to speak so that they can be discredited and so that they can be protested against. I think that you would have seen a huge wave of protest at University of Cardiff if she had been invited to speak. So something that I quite liked about the interview that she did on Newsnight, which we'll link in the show notes, promise, it will happen, is that she has zero fucks to give. She doesn't care. She's basically like, I'm old now, I can say what I want.
And what does that mean?
I admit the unfortunate term of phrase. I quite admire the balls that she has for saying something like that.
So you wouldn't actually bar her from speaking then?
No, I still wouldn't bar her from speaking, but I think that it should be welcomed that she gets robustly kind of pulled down from her perch.
I'm not sure she would, though, because I'm not sure what the sort of ratio is for feminists who have that inclusive attitude to transgender people versus feminists that don't. I get the sense that feminists that don't are actually a far larger proportion than you might necessarily expect.
Can we talk about briefly what she said about Caitlyn Jenner?
Yeah, what do you think about what she said about... is it Caitlyn Jenner or Caitlyn Jenner?
I think it's Caitlyn.
Okay.
So it's Caitlyn Moran, Caitlyn Jenner.
Fucking English.
So she said... So Jermaine Greer basically said that Caitlyn Jenner decided to publicly transition from male to female in terms of how she presents in public for the media attention, which has been a common thing and a common criticism of her public profile. And also said that I believe that she's being given an award by a magazine as woman and being told that she and being awarded as Woman of the Year. And Germaine Greer said that that was misogyny because a man was getting Woman of the Year. And I'm like, right. I'm just genuinely blown sideways.
I feel you should definitely explain your position a little more fully than just going, yeah, right. So,
well, because the problem is that Germaine Greer does not believe that transgender women are women. I believe that transgender women are women. Most transgender women believe that they are women. I believe.
You're saying there's some that don't.
I refuse to speak on behalf
only a Sif speaks in absolutes, right?
Yeah. And so for goodness sake, it's just she needs to get her head out of the past and accept that there are different forms of femininity, and I feel like she has a very specific kind of idea of what femininity and being female is. And a very different one to what we've kind of evolved it into being. And I think that that is a flaw in her argument and a flaw in general of second wave feminism that has kind of been readdressed by third and fourth wave feminists by trying to be more inclusive of all experiences of womanhood.
I don't have anything else to say, so.
Okay, fine. Germaine Greer's a fucking idiot.
I mean, I don't think she's an idiot.
No, I think she's I think she needs to get her head out of her
I mean, you said she was quite an intelligent woman.
But on this particular topic, she's an idiot, so that's all I have to say on the matter.
That, you know, the student union shouldn't have banned her, you know, feminazis in action.
Oh, why did you... No, why did you have to say that? Oh.
This week, Xi Jinping...
Very good.
The Chinese,
I didn't cringe.
The Chinese president visited Britain on the first state visit of a Chinese president for, is it a decade or so?
Yeah. It's his first state visit to a European country as president.
There you go.
I believe.
And the key themes from the British government's point of view is about investment, specifically investment from China into various things that are happening in Britain, most controversial of which is a nuclear power plant.
At Hinkley Point.
And David Cameron and George Osborne have been criticised by a lot of people for not really confronting the Chinese about their questionable human rights record. Mm-hmm. Jazza, do you think that when it comes to kind of geopolitical diplomacy on this scale, Britain can't really afford to be too challenging towards a country like China?
Shall I give a bit of the background of my relationship in China?
Go ahead.
My relationship with China. So I lived in China for 2 years. I studied there. I speak the language. I understand the culture and how stuff is done there reasonably well. So that's the disclosure out of the way. Basically, listen to me because my thoughts are valid and important.
I mean, you used to work for the Taiwanese embassy.
And I used to work for the Taiwanese...
So you might be biased and hateful against China, the real China.
Well, actually... No. Wow. Okay. Wow. So I actually don't think that the human rights record in China is a particularly important thing that should be brought up by Western governments. I think it's quite patronising, and I'll tell you why. I'm glad you didn't ask me. But I'll tell you why anyway.
because Jazza, why do you hate Chinese people and don't want them to have human rights?
I don't think that, but I think that when you look at the choices that the Chinese Communist Party has taken in terms of how it's going to reform, the most important thing that they have kind of identified is stability in the Chinese country. We've talked about this in the past.
Yeah, we have, yeah.
And prosperity, right? And China would have never been able to do that under a more fluid kind of
liberal government.
Government. And it's very clearly made that choice. Now, what's also very important is that most Chinese people are quite happy with the status quo as it is. And so I think that it's quite patronising for us when we were developing equally as quickly during the Victorian era, where we had like a questionable human rights record, like children down mines, for example. I think it's quite patronising for us to say, oh yeah, China, it's great that you're developing really, really quickly, but you're going to have to adhere to all of these things that we didn't have to adhere to when we were developing very quickly and trying to make the lives of our people better.
I mean, this does appear to be whataboutery of the worst kind.
Whataboutery? What's that?
It's where somebody makes a criticism of you. So I say, Jazza, that is a terrible man bun you've got on the go. And then you go, Jimmy, well, your beard is shit. And it's a means of like trying to it's basically saying your argument is wrong because there's this other thing going on that you've done wrong in the past. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really work as a logical proposition, is what I'm saying.
I disagree. So there. So basically, I think it's annoying for the Chinese when Western leaders insist on bringing up human rights abuses, because China, I don't think that China doesn't want to have a good record when it comes to human rights, but they just have a different way of doing things in terms of like...
I mean, a way of doing things that involves not actually having proper human rights.
We have similar kind of relationships with Middle Eastern countries, with African countries, and we're very happy to deal with them internationally. It just feels
most people would say, who complain about human rights abuses in China, would make the same complaints about Saudi Arabia, which I assume was the other major country you were referring to. I mean, I do see where you're coming from, and there's a certain extent to which we can't really pressure China because of the size of its economy and its, you know, burgeoning global power in terms of military and what have you. But it does seem to me that if you believe in human rights, you have to believe them in a universal sense. And you might, that doesn't mean that you have to effect regime change in all 180 countries in the world to actually bring this about. But it does mean that you should at least express some disapproval at the bare minimum
when countries abuse their citizens. But when you're doing a state visit, I don't think it's particularly helpful.
The Americans did it. Barack Obama made far more comments about human rights and talked a lot more about human rights than David Cameron did.
Yeah, and she and Obama have got a terrible relationship because of that. And so what's really interesting, let's go back to this visit. So this visit was particularly interesting because in 2012, the British government basically had their knuckles wrapped because David Cameron decided to meet the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama is seen as the spiritual leader of the Tibetan people and is basically seen as a dissident by the Chinese Communist Party because he believes in an independent Tibet, etc., etc., etc. And whenever an international leader decides to meet with the Dalai Lama, that country is usually kind of like given the cold shoulder by the Communist Party in China. And that's exactly what happened. We've had quite frosty relations with the Chinese for the past like 3 years. And so when China kind of saw that Cameron had met Mr. Lama and had they basically said, yeah, you shouldn't have done that. We're not very happy with you. And Cameron basically went, I'm really sorry, it won't happen again. I won't meet him again. I'm really sorry. And so this is kind of a reward for him saying that he'll never do something like that again.
I mean, that's pretty embarrassing, like, from our point of view.
Yeah, hugely embarrassing.
No, I mean, the fact that he didn't say, suck it, you know.
Yeah, they're going to be the biggest economy in the world in, like, 15 years. Like, we cannot... You have to... This is diplomacy. You have to give someone... take some.
I suppose, but I'm not really sure. I mean, we're taking the money, I guess. Yeah. But,
okay, we'll talk about that later, but yeah, go on.
Yeah, I mean, talk about it now. What do you think about the money side of things?
Basically, we're selling the UK. Great, whee! We're selling off lots of really integral infrastructure that I don't understand why it couldn't be done by British companies or by, through more traditional ways of running stuff like the rail services and infrastructure when it comes to like nuclear power. I think that it is very difficult to do business with the Chinese on this kind of a scale, especially with stuff like nuclear power, because China kind of has barriers when you're dealing with part state-owned companies. So when a Chinese state-owned company, which is the majority of those that are allowed to do business outside of China, go to the UK to start to run a nuclear power plant, for example, British contractors are quite limited in how much auditing they're allowed to do of the Chinese company.
See, with the Hinkley Point nuclear power deal, from what I understand, it's purely a money thing. It's being built by the French. Like, the Chinese are, I think they're putting in a third of the money it's taking to actually get it set up. I don't, from what I understand, the Chinese are not involved in running it at all, really. Is that wrong?
No, I don't think you're wrong, but I think that the fact that we're going to the Chinese is kind of a shame when it comes to British manufacturing and British infrastructure, because we're not actually building any of the new exciting stuff that is coming into this country. And in the past we have, and we can do that.
So what are you're talking about manufacturing then?
I mean, like, construction and building and stuff like that.
But in a lot of ways, we're never going to be able to compete with poorer economies when it comes to things like that, because they'll always be able to undercut us, won't they?
How do you mean?
So one of the things that's happened this week is the shutdown of the steel plant. I should have looked up the details, but the reason this plant has shut down has partly been blamed on China dumping large amounts of steel onto the international market. Dumping is when you sell something below its cost to run your competitors out of business, and then you hike the prices up. And there is some evidence that China has done this, although it may be due more to an excess of steel production on their part. They produce half the world's steel or something. Than to actually, it might partly be a competitive thing, but funnily enough, Jermaine Greer was on Question Time this week making roughly this point that we can no longer compete in a lot of those, like, first and second sector job markets now. We have to compete in things like financial services and what have you.
Yeah. No, like, I completely agree. But to sell off parts of our country and parts of really integral bits of our of how the country works, like power and like infrastructure, I think is potentially...
I don't think we're selling it off, though. I think they're investing in it, which is not really the same thing.
Maybe you're right.
I mean, right now the Chinese have a significant investment in how our water supplies are run. I'm not sure the exact size of this investment, but...
So I've touted myself as a Chinese expert. You know more about these deals than I do.
I'm not sure I do. I just read it. I just read it in The Economist, so it must be true. But yeah, if it's just them putting money in, and they're not really exerting a great deal of control. There's not the suggestion that, like, China's going to be able to, like, just shut down a nuclear power plant in 15 years' time.
No, but
when they get a bit shirty with us.
But correct me if I'm wrong, but there is the implication that if they decide to pull out for whatever reason, if it's not profitable and if it's not turning a profit, then that can result in the British government having to come in at the taxpayers' expense in order to save the project, right?
Yeah, but I suppose you could look at it another way. If they weren't investing now, the British government might be the ones having to stump up the money and might end up losing money anyway. So, I mean, what's the difference between those two options?
You're probably right. So, yeah, you come in China and buy everything. Or invest in everything, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure about this whole sort of suspicion about foreign money argument. I mean, Britain actually takes in way more, like, foreign investment than, say, the rest of the EU.
Yeah.
And it's just something that we happen to do. And people always complain, like, oh, we're selling off, like, you know, when Cadbury's was sold to, like, an American company or whatever, there was a huge hoo-ha because it feels like we're selling off companies. But I'm not sure why it matters in a lot of...
So I agree, I'm not sure why it matters, but it still sits really badly with me because it feels like we're no longer... Do you understand this feeling of, oh, we can't do this, so we need to bring in somebody else to do it?
I understand the feeling, but I sort of think it's irrational at the same time. So I kind of think, like, oh, Aston Martin is no longer owned by British company. It's owned by a foreign conglomerate or whatever, a coalition of different foreign companies. And I kind of understand that kind of sense of, it's like almost nationalist or angst, if you like.
Yeah, no, that's definitely where my feeling comes from.
But by the same token, I'm not really sure why it matters. I mean, there's certainly, like, advantages to controlling certain industries. So the fact that most big technology companies are American. That gives them huge amounts of geopolitical power and control is maybe the wrong word. It gives the American government influence over how that sector develops.
Which is very interesting with China, because they basically have their own kind of like tech bubble, because they've banned every single American tech company from having a service in mainland China.
Yeah, although to be fair, I think a lot of American companies would find it much harder than they'd think to actually go and sell services in China because of all the cultural differences and all the...
Google was doing okay before they pulled out. Google had like a 30% search engine product share, where Baidu, which is like the Chinese Google, and it's hilarious because it is exactly the same website, but just in Chinese. It's great, and it's piracy at its worst. But it's very interesting to see how they very deliberately created their own ecosystem in that kind of like sector, because it's something that they feel like they need to control in information and communication.
Yeah, I mean, I know what you mean, I think it does matter in certain sectors, but to some extent, there's no point like every country in the world having its own steel manufacturing. So some countries, by definition, have to not have them, and that applies for quite a lot of different things. And the fact we have foreign investment, I think, is probably a net benefit. You know, whether it works out that there's actually political control over things or political influence, I'm sure that is true to some extent, but.
I'm telling you, there 100% is, because all of the companies that are allowed to invest externally from China are at least partially state owned. Yeah. Like every single company.
Are you saying we should be refusing more Chinese money, or is that where your position is?
I think we should be more intelligent. I think that our relationship with China should be more than just us giving them investment opportunities. I think that our relationship with China should be talking about stuff. Oh, like this is dodgy, but for example, like the democratic kind of foundation that was placed on that was created in Hong Kong that has now been kind of like erosions, taken away. Yeah. And I think that when it comes to human rights abuses, I think that we should be talking about something like Hong Kong a lot more than freedom of speech, for example, because Hong Kong is somewhere where Western liberalism was planted and thrived, and it was the hub of East Asia for a very long time, and that's now being eroded very deliberately. And these are a lot of people that used to be British citizens, and I think that that should have been something, a point of contention, and I'm always kind of a bit disappointed when that isn't a public point of contention for... But with the relationship between the UK and China.
Yeah, I agree. That I don't think it's going to help anything us discussing this any further.
Oh, okay, fine. Bye.
Bye bye.
Zaijian.
Zaijian.
Very good. Bye bye. Seamus Milne. Who is he? Why should I care about him?
Well, he was a Guardian columnist, and now he's on leave because he's taken up a role as head of strategy and communications at Labour, which in real terms is he's the spin doctor at Labour now under Jeremy Corbyn. That's why you should care about it.
Cool. What does a spin doctor exactly do?
Sort of lies for a living. I mean, it's... you know, if you're in PR, you'd probably say massages the truth, or, you know, makes the truth a little bit more appealing to the masses. Mm-hmm. But yeah, lying is sort of semi-covers it. It's a little bit harsh, but yeah, it's true.
His job is to basically make Jeremy Corbyn seem vaguely electable, right?
That was the idea, and that's the reason that Milne's appointment has been so controversial, because with... Alistair Campbell, and who is Tony Blair's spin doctor, he was known as having like being quite forthright and quite partisan towards the Labour Party when he was at the Mirror as a political journalist. But he didn't go on the record with a lot of very controversial views, whereas Milne, for years and years and years, has been writing sort of in a very anti-Western vein. He's the sort of person who... whatever problem that's happening in the world, he'll be able to trace it back somehow to Western imperialism, to use his turn of phrase.
And this has been seen as the problem with his appointment, right? Because he's seen as quote-unquote Britain-hating.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he hates Britain, but he definitely hates America. That is, you know, he's definitely very strongly anti-American. You know, with some justification, not everything that American has done in the realm of foreign policy has been a roaring success, shall we say. But the problem, I think, is that obviously as a political hack, he's really well known throughout Fleet Street, and everyone who's writing about him has met him. I guess you could say the same is true of Alastair Campbell, but the extremity of his views, particularly in relation to the general population, the general public, is such that I think a lot of people have seen this move as pushing Corbyn even further away from the mainstream political thought than he previously was.
And the general kind of opinion was that Jeremy Corbyn was going to have to try and be more inclusive because a small number of the parliamentary of MPs, of Labour MPs, actually kind of aligned themselves with somebody like Jeremy Corbyn, and it was thought that he was going to have to become more moderate in a lot of his stances. But this appointment kind of cements the fact that he's going to be quite an anti-Western kind of leader. Am I right in saying that?
I think so. It certainly suggests that that's the case. And another reason that this is controversial, and this links in with your point, is that Milner's being interviewed on Russia Today a couple of weeks ago, and he was discussing like the Labour purge in terms of Labour MPs who didn't toe the Corbyn line being deselected and being replaced with someone more amenable to Corbyn's point of view. And Milne kind of suggested that this could happen. He didn't exactly express strong disapproval of it. And now he's, you know, the chief spin doctor at Labour under Corbyn.
So should the Tristram Hunts and the Liz Kendalls be quaking in their boots then?
I don't think he'd take someone out quite as high profile as that. But I think I'm not even sure they'll move in that direction right now. But yeah, I mean, it does rather suggest that if you're on the Blairite wing of the Labour Party, you're about to be even more marginalised than you previously were.
Sure. Doesn't this basically mean then that Jeremy Corbyn has only got a very specific period of time before he is going to be replaced as leader by somebody more mainstream? Because this is clearly quite combative, having somebody like that spinning for him and somebody on his side, and it's going to make him less kind of accepted with the parliamentary Labour Party, right? So it's going to mean that they're going to want to kick him out even sooner? Because there was thought, like I said before, there were thoughts that he was going to become more moderate, and that maybe people would be able to rally behind him. But that's clearly not going to happen with this kind of an appointment.
It would definitely seem that that's not the way things are going.
And it also happened when he like announced his shadow cabinet and stuff. And all those
he was, to be fair, he was a bit more broad church approach when he announced his cabinet, because he asked Andy Burnham to be his Home Secretary, was it? And he asked Hillary Benn to be his Foreign Secretary.
Yeah, because Andy Burnham was the only person also running for the leadership that didn't say that he wouldn't sit in a
Burnham, when asked by like a Sun journalist, an undercover Sun journalist, what do you think about Corbyn's election to the Labour Party? This was on the eve of the election.
Yeah.
He said it will be a disaster. Well, he said privately it will be a disaster, and then obviously privately
and then publicly
became public. Yeah. Publicly, and then seemingly with no shame, he joined the Corbyn cabinet. So that's cool, I guess. That's all right. I don't know. It seems as though you think things are really fucked with Corbyn, and then they
just keeps getting worse.
I'm not sure why.
So what do we need to be looking out for with Seamus Milne then? What do you think anything is going to change in terms of the messaging that that Jeremy Corbyn is going to have in terms of his opposition to government?
Well, I think it's as you said, it will be more down the line, it will be more hardline, really. And one of the criticisms of Alastair Campbell when he was working for Tony Blair is that they were so fixated on winning the election and winning the public's approval and winning the approval of Fleet Street that a lot of people criticised Tony Blair's government as being, they had policy directed by public image as opposed to like taking the policies they wanted and then massaging them so that they could be more presentable to the public. You're not going to get that with Milne, I don't think, because he's too much of a hardliner in his views.
Yeah, I mean, I think he would broadly describe himself as a socialist. Mm-hmm. You could even argue he's
which isn't as dirty a word in the UK as it is in the US, but still.
Hashtag feel the burn.
Yes, we have to get that into every podcast.
Yeah. but yeah, I think you could probably even call him a communist in some ways. I mean, he's gone on the he's said some questionable things about Stalin's regime in the USSR, and he does acknowledge.
What did he say?
Well, it's more that he acknowledges the war crimes and then goes, oh, but all of this cool stuff was happening. And it's like, yeah, but genocides. You know, it's not like when you know, if you're attacking the Tories right now, you say, those bastards, you know, they implementing tax credits. Oh, but they're doing this nice stuff as well. But it doesn't really work when you have, you know, people in gulags dying and mm-hmm. It's very much in the vein. Somebody wrote on the New Statesman's website, it almost appears as though Milne is more interested in geopolitics than people, mm-hmm. Which I think is a fair summary of the problem with some of his views.
So you've told me this in the past, that foreign policy is the area in which you disagree most with Jeremy Corbyn. What specifically do you disagree with him on?
It's probably on the anti-American point. Mm-hmm. I think I'm nicer about America than a lot of people on the left in general.
Yeah.
Their foreign policy, you know, elements of their foreign policy notwithstanding. But I see America's decline as quite a sad thing, or the potential decline and their potential replacement by China as the world's superpower, mm-hmm. as a bad thing, because whilst there are, you know, America has problems with, gun crime, and it's a very partisan political culture, and some of the stuff they've done in terms of foreign policy is awful. But that said, they are, and I've done basically what I've just criticised Milne for doing, that said, they are more in line with our values than the Chinese are. Mm-hmm. And I think the world, firstly, will be a less safe place when there isn't a global hegemon with the kind of status of the US, when you have several different superpowers. I think that makes for a more dangerous world, because there's no indication of who the top dog is. Mm-hmm. And so it creates more of a potential for conflict.
But what we have seen with our move towards a multipolar world, so multipolar basically means that the US is no longer the main superpower, and places like China and Russia and Brazil are kind of India. Coming up, and India are becoming much more significant on the international stage and having more sway.
Yeah.
What seems to have happened so far is that China specifically has just kind of like taken a back seat and been like, it's in the UN specifically, and has been like, you guys deal with that and we won't get involved. How is that a negative thing, or do you fear that China is then going to start kind of like throwing its weight around?
Oh, China's already started throwing its weight around.
So it throws its weight around, I think, in its region quite a lot, but I think internationally, in terms of like Syria, for example, China has been very, very absent.
It is true that China is not all that involved in the Middle East. And some people have made the argument that what we're seeing is the development of regional powers like Russia in Eastern Europe, China in Asia Pacific, Brazil, I guess, in South America to a far lesser extent. Mm-hmm. And you can view it that way, but, you know, as you see with World War I and World War II, regional conflicts have, you know, a very large capacity to escalate into global mm-hmm. conflicts. I actually prefer the American world order, I guess. A lot of people would say it allowed America the levity to, you know, do things like Iraq and Vietnam and Afghanistan, arguably. And that is true, but I view that as a better, it's not great, but it's a better alternative to what I think we're seeing developing now.
So what are we seeing develop now?
It's the multipolar thing.
But why is that bad? Why is that a bad thing?
Because when
the US being able to throw its weight around absolutely everywhere versus it having regional power, surely that is fairer, I guess.
No, I just think you could say it's fairer. It's also less stable. Mm-hmm. It means that China's increasingly challenging American dominance in Asia Pacific, basically. America, despite not actually having any territory or having very minimal territory mm-hmm. in Asia Pacific, was the...
I believe Guam counts.
Guam, yeah. was the supreme naval power in Asia Pacific from end of World War II up until pretty much the present day. Mm-hmm. That is now changing. And it means that, admittedly, America might back down, but when you have two powers where both of them are thinking, we could potentially win this thing, that is far more dangerous than if you have one power that says, there's no way we can win this thing, and the other power that says, they're not even going to try.
We've kind of gone off of Seamus, what's his surname?
Seamus Milne.
We've kind of gone off of Seamus Milne a little bit, but I want to ask you a very specific question that's very interesting to me.
Okay.
So, fuck this. basically, Taiwan, which is the, which considers itself the government in exile of China.
I mean, I hate to break it to you, Taiwan, but you lost that war. I'm sorry. Yeah. The writing is very much on the wall with that particular conflict.
So they have a presidential election at the beginning of next year where it looks like the DPP, which is the pro-independence party in Taiwan, is going to win. Now, China hates that because China sees Taiwan as part of China.
Is there anywhere in Asia that China doesn't see as part of China?
Unfair. Lots of places.
Unfair, but somewhat true.
but so there's a fear in Taiwan that because of the lack of American dominance, if the DPP were to go down any kind of an independence route, that they would not get the support of the US in any way, shape or form. Is that what you mean by having a more unstable world with an America with reduced power?
Yeah, basically. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what I mean.
So how does this... why does this matter if the opposition party in the UK, that frankly, under this leadership, is never going to get into power, why does it matter that they've chosen to have somebody who believes more in this multipolar world?
It probably doesn't matter because, as you say, they're not going to get into power. Mainly because, you know, Corbyn is not able to build that broad mainstream left... that is able to win elections. Mm-hmm. But it's... So in that sense, from Lowe's point of view, it doesn't matter. But in other countries in Europe, the sort of views that Milne and Corbyn espouse are more likely to gain some sort of traction. And in that sense...
For example, places like Spain, which has Podemos.
Spain, Greece, I guess,
Greece
as well.
Greece with Syriza, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think the Milne appointment is going to escalate the conflict between Japan and China over the name of those islands.
Oh, Senkaku Diaoyutai.
There you go. I don't think that is going to have any ramifications. But in broad terms, that kind of point of view and the decline of America, I think, is a bad thing. But we have gone way off topic.
We have gone way off topic. Yeah. So how long to finish this topic off? How long do you think Corbyn's got?
We did this last time. Are we going to do this every week now?
Yeah.
I still think he's... Well, I think he's... I said May last time, and I actually think he's probably got longer than that because of the size of his mandate within the Labour Party. Mm-hmm. But if he does terribly badly at May, in May, at the...
Local elections.
Scottish and Welsh elections. It could be bad.
Da, 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 da. If you disagree with us on anything,
don't tell us.
Don't
we're
tell
not
us.
Interested.
How dare you? You can tweet us at Right Dishonor. I'm at Jazza John. Jimmy is at JDE Nichols with one L.
Two L's.
Fuck
you, man. Jesus.
I can't. Dyslexia. And you can also go to the website rightdishonorable.com and read all of the articles that Jimmy writes. Because yes. I'm still not writing anything. I thought about writing one this week.
I mean, it's the thought that counts.
Yeah, exactly. So. It means I've basically done it. See you next week, I guess.
Or hear. Hear us next week.
Hear us next week, I guess. Bye. Love you.